ungodly name. And the sign flashed out its warning in the words that it was forming. And the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls.
Love and light, everybody. I'm Reverend Phil, and I'm your host for Words of the Prophets. This show's format consists of a discussion regarding the application of spiritual principles in all aspects of our daily lives. Normally, you, the listening audience, are encouraged to participate in this discussion. However, that will not be possible today since the show has been pre-recorded, which will become evident when I tell you who my guest is. My guest is Rabbi Malcolm Drucker. Hi, Rabbi.
Good to be here, Phil.
So Saturday, when this will be playing, Rabbi will be in congregation. This morning's topic is forgive myself, and a phrase comes from C.P. Snow, and it reads as follows. Take the trouble to know myself, be appalled by what I see, and then forgive myself. So before we get started, let me remind everybody that our show has been pre-recorded, is being pre-recorded, and therefore don't call in to talk to us, but you can call in and leave a message for me with the engineer, or we'll give you ways to contact us at the end of the show. I don't even know where to begin. Actually, the first thing I wanted to do, who is C.P. Snow?
C.P. Snow was a writer in the 30s and 40s, Reverend Phil, who was a novelist who had wrote a wonderful book called The Masters, which is a story of how a dean who is dying is being chosen for a school like Oxford. And it was in that novel I came across this amazing notion that seems to me the entire process of forgiveness. Those three steps. First, you have to look at yourself, be completely horrified.
Take the trouble to know myself.
That's right. Be horrified. And then, which is where most of us fall down, is we can't get ourselves back up again, but we've got to remember it's the flaw upon which we stand to redeem ourselves. There's no place else to do it.
And you talk about that. I've got so many of your quotations here. I'm not even going to try to find it, but you talk about basically it's a function. If we are actually following God's will for us, then God forgives us. How can we not forgive ourselves? What I'd like to do with today's show is a little different than I've done recently. I want to talk about personal spiritual evolution, and you have so much wonderful stuff on your website. At the end of the show, you've got to give out your website. For those of you who will take the time, there's a category for sermons, and there's a whole bunch of sermons there, and I read four of them, and they are so chock full of goodies. It's just it's wonderful. There were four of them that I chose. One of them is a personal theology, and that talks about what it sounds like was your own evolutionary spiritual path within the confines of, it sounded almost like within the confines of Judaism, but then to the point where you found stuff in the Jewish tradition that allowed you to grow outside of it, or at least outside of what I think I know about Judaism. So can you... do you want me to read some of this, or do you want to just talk about it? What works best for you?
We could do both, Phil. Because it's because it's a continuum. I wrote this, a few years ago, and I guess the reason that we wake up each morning is that we continue our evolution. So read away if you'd like. That's fine.
Okay. The first one, but in the end, what matters is who you have become from your lessons. While everything I know someone has taught me, each of us, through our specific experience, carries a unique vision, a sliver of the divine whole. Each of us is here to shine a new light. There's another one in here. I love this one, too. God dwelled not in me, nor in Torah, nor in my rabbi, but between us. God became the bridge, the connection that allowed me to transcend myself, to see that at a liminal moment, I am part of you and you are part of me. I was born and raised Jewish, and this was not something that I've ever heard. I might have still have practiced the faith that I heard some of this stuff back then. Where does this come from? I mean, can you bring it together, I mean, personally and within the context of Judaism?
The paper which you're referring to is actually something I wrote in the seminary. And It includes my teachers, those on the planet and not on the planet. The teacher who taught me about God dwelling between us is Harold Schulweis, a rabbi in California. This is a Reconstructionist philosophy, denomination of Judaism that's not very well known. And the source is its founder, Mordecai Kaplan, who understood that we Jews are here still after 3,500 years because we live between two worlds. And each of us wakes up in the morning in two worlds. We wake up inside ourselves and our personal concerns into this larger world. And then as a people, you live in this larger world, and then you have your community of traditions and folkways. What we need more than anything is God's presence in our lives. Each of us walks around working so hard for so many things, and we get to the bottom of it. I think what we're really looking for is to feel a sense of belonging and a sense of connection. Religion, by the way, religio means connection. So Kaplan understood that in this world, the place that we're going to find this God is not going to be some, you know, hairy guy in the sky. It's going to be between you and me.
How does, I mean, and I, not that I disagree with this. I mean, I totally agree with this. But where, how does this evolve? I mean, I get, you know, and I guess I'm just putting out my ignorance here, but that's okay. I mean, basically, you know, is this coming out of, this is not coming out of the first five books. This is more coming, what sounds like would be little I know about the Kabbalah. Is that accurate or?
See, you see, you're a guy with a beard. Your listeners may not know that, but you, I mean, you could be a Talmudist because that question is always asked, you know, where is it written? What's your source? What's your proof text? And it's a good question. It isn't Torah.
And
it is in the five books.
Okay, and it's not like I'm even asking you to prove it.
I know that. You know, I hear that.
You know, it's kind of like these are not the thing. I mean, I went to Hebrew school and I didn't pay a whole lot of attention. And once I got bar mitzvahed, I never went back again. And that's probably a very usual story. But I never heard any of this. You know, I mean, I never heard anything other than, if I didn't do certain things, I was going to be punished. I didn't hear forgiveness. I didn't hear loving. I didn't hear that God was within me and without of me. I didn't hear any of that. It might not have mattered. I don't know. You know, I mean, I was a kid, and I was pretty crazy at the time. But I don't remember hearing any of this. And that's why, I mean, when I saw this, it was just like, wow, you know, this is like so incredible. You want to?
What I really hear is the question behind the question,
which is,
how come I never heard this stuff? If this is Judaism, I mean, that's really the question. Why don't you know it? And that is a wonderful question. I mentioned that I wrote this book about women spiritual leaders in America, so I have rabbis in there, but I also have a witch in there, Starhawk, and I also have Marianne Williamson in there, and I also have a Hindu, Ma Jaya. All were born Jews. I didn't know that before I met them.
Fascinating.
And they say the same thing you say, you know, like, if I had known this. Here's what I understand. Religion is very dangerous. It may be the most dangerous thing in the world. Judaism, Jews certainly took the hit at the wrong end of the passion in religion. And I think that some of what frightened the Jews was, first of all, what they saw in terms of persecution against them by other religions full of passion, as well as within its own tradition, seeing that people could be led in many directions and that you have to be very careful. So what I think is, if the metaphor might be light, the light has to be contained in a vessel. And the vessel has to be strong enough to hold the light. And I think the fear is the light could blind us. So what happens is they just gave us a lot of gobbledygook and a lot of laws and all that about love. But Talmud tells us The Torah begins with love. When God goes ballistic at Adam and Eve and says, you're on your own, kids, out of here. Next thing God says is, wait, you're naked. And God makes them clothes. This is loving kindness. Ends with loving kindness. Moses is dying to see the promised land. Not a chance Moses is going to see the promised land. Yet God softens the disappointment by giving him a kiss. And that is the kiss that ends his life. So the whole book, really, Christianity sort of set up a notion that the Old Testament is law, the New Testament is love. But I would say that I find in the Jewish Bible, which is the Old Testament, plenty of love.
And I think one of the things you said early really resonates, and I don't think it's exclusive to Judaism. I think that there has been an evolution in most religions that the masses can't handle the truth, so we won't tell it to them and we keep things from them. And it's about really proving yourself worthy by dedication and, you know, lots of study that more truth will be revealed, which makes a lot of sense. But what it does is it leaves you, you know, the initiate with this misunderstanding, you know, that doesn't maybe hinders them or kills their desire to go further in that particular discipline. And I don't think that's just true of Judaism. I mean, I think that's been true of most religions that as I understand them, that, you know, it's like, you know, Christianity kept a whole lot of secrets and a whole lot of information from the masses because they couldn't handle it and only started to release little bits and pieces as a means to get them when, you know, like almost like a marketing thing when they were losing, you know, to other religions. But it was not about trying to really carry that message. It was about, no, you're not worthy of the message. You won't be able to deal with the understandings and we'll have chaos.
Good point. You know, I'm not an Orthodox Jew. I'm a paradox Jew.
So Explain that.
The paradox, there are two paradoxes. One is the individual and the community. So one of the safeguards, as you say, is study so that we understand really what love means. But the ultimate message is, in Judaism, love. But how do we get there? But the other piece of it is that you could be wrong. I could be wrong. If we're in a community, the likelihood is we're going to come closer together to what really this will may be. So that's one paradox. And I think what's going on in all, as you say, in all religions now is the emphasis towards the individual is very important because it no longer works for us to be just part of an institution. Second, and this is what my white fire idea is about, I think it's also sort of a rebalancing of masculine and feminine energies in all religions that's going on right now that I'm seeing, that a lot of this, what you felt kept us from, you know, the truth, et cetera, I think also had a lot to do with hierarchical organization. And again, distant. We saw the robe. What's happening with more women coming into the tradition is we want more of mama. We want more of that love piece.
That's interesting. I mean, that's something I've had on some other shows, Malka, where we talked about the origin of the feminine and how it was overwhelmed by the masculine and its sense of trying to come back again because it's definitely necessary in balance. But I got to read you one of your own quotes. I don't know if you remember this, and I took them out of context, but it's exactly what you just said. Each of us is in school, the world being the classroom. The text is Torah in the broadest sense, and the lesson is how to love, how not to see ourselves in opposition, but in relationship and connection. And it's beautiful. I mean, I love it. When I was reading these, I was just like, wow. You know, to me, that's what it's all about. And, you know, I don't want to keep repeating myself over again, but all I kept hearing was if I didn't do this, I was no good. I was going to be damned. I mean, I found Judaism to be so so structured and so, how do I put it, restrictive. I mean, the kosher laws. I grew up in an Orthodox house, obviously, and it just didn't make sense. And I wasn't allowed to question it. I was just told, you don't question it, you do it or else. And being the rebel, I said, I'll choose or else. I don't want to do this. You know, and I didn't see love in any of that. I saw a lot of hypocrisy in a lot of that. And I'm not sure where I'm going with all this rambling, but I want to throw one other thing in here. A couple of weeks back, I did a show. And prior to the opening of the show, I read an open letter to Dr. Laura. It was about where she was using one of the quotes out of Leviticus as proof that, you know, God is against homosexuality in any form. And this gentleman writes in and quotes a whole lot of other parts of Leviticus and a little bit of Exodus and talks about how, well, we're not really doing these things either. Like if we grow two grains in the same field, we should be punished. And there's a whole bunch of that. And he was like, you know, if you burn a bull and the smell is good to God, well, what about my neighbors and complaining? Should I stone them? And, you know, it was a lot of good stuff. And but the point it made was that at the time there was probably a big need for the structure, but that the evolution, you know, time, we evolve and we change, and some of that structure is no longer relevant. Am I stating that clearly?
Yes, I think it's true. Yet I have to say, though, I think, Reverend Phil, that we are hardwired for the rituals of our life. If you sing Daisy, Daisy in the shower every morning, it's a ritual. We have a practice. You could be a Buddhist, it doesn't matter. What you say about the emptiness of what you saw growing up as an Orthodox Jew, I've often spoken with Christians who will say, all that I got was the restriction. I never got what any of this was really about. But you know what's interesting, and a good example of this is, look, there was a time when we, barbecued little animals as a way to show God we loved God, right? Yeah. And very few people that I know, very few Jews that I know, still recommend that as a way to receive God's love and show God our love. Judaism became a new religion at the same time as the Jesus movement that became Christianity. Because when the temple was destroyed and there was no longer any place to do this, they had to then read this text to say, what else could this possibly mean? I take this personally in my life because I say to myself that this is an this tradition speaks of evolution, speaks of growing every single day. And that if that's what this is about, that this law that I study isn't supposed to teach me necessarily the letter, but the spirit. Well, it's the same thing in my own life. What was appropriate for me to do when I was 5 years old to learn, how to cross streets is no longer. I don't have to still go through the same exercise. But I still know that in my life, I still need to know what my boundaries are, to know who I am, to recognize them for what they are, and to understand this is just Malka. And Malka is just one cell in a gigantic organism that makes up an entire universe that she can add her voice to, add her energy towards. But that's all. That's what those rules are about, is to give you a sense of how to contain your light, that vessel metaphor again, so that you can go out and do the work that you were put on this earth to do. That's just, you know, straight ahead Judaism. I'm sorry that, you know, we didn't grow up in the same community. I didn't grow up with it either. Yet I know that I don't know why the word hasn't gotten out there, you know. That's why I'm on your show this morning, you know, Reverend Definitely. Phil, so I can get that word out there.
How could you – let's put this in a little bit broader perspective for the present time. That which you are talking about, your understanding of Judaism, how prevalent, how predominant is that now in the world of Judaism? Is it a majority, minority, small minority? I mean, I'm just curious as to what, how this fits in 2003 Judaism.
You know, it's like anything. You know, good, there's not a lot of good anywhere. There's not a lot. You know, good is always a really small percentage of whatever is going on. And I think that that's how many congregations really rock with a sense of love and a sense that here really is a way to help me get through this day and night of the time in which we live. I mean, how, forget the religion. I mean, how many places do we really find that?
And I agree with you. I mean, I think that is essential. I think that's why I really believe most religions are letting the population down because they don't teach that. And that hopefully is part of the message of this show, which is part of what I consider my ministry. So maybe all of which I've gone through, you know, was to get me to this place where I could try to get out a message similar to what your message is. I mean, I got to throw another one out of here. I just, again, Rabbi, I just love the stuff that you've been writing. I see my existence as a path to discover my essence, which is part of the One. That's beautiful. And I think that's what we need to see, is that we're part of the One. And it's not just Judaism. I think that, you know, Christianity and it's all its many forms, and Islam and it's all its many forms, and so many of them do not teach that. And we lose that, and that's what I try to do here, is show that there's this common message at the base of each of these religions, that it's there if you look for it, it's there if you want it.
Again, the notion of a wheel with spokes, you know, everything leads to the same place. It really does. And I think, I mean, the reason, you know, you chose one path, Phil, as a Jew, I chose another. Maybe the reason that I'm a rabbi and you're a reverend today has to do with I saw, you know, my grandfather loved his Judaism, and I loved my grandfather, and I wanted to keep him with me. And one of the ways that I think that I've kept those whom I loved so and who taught me so is by keeping the tradition that they so loved. So, I mean, I think that...
And I never saw that love.
Of course not. And I think that... And that's really what sort of makes the difference of who we become and what we are. And I think that... What ultimately, say, take the matter of forgiveness. I mean, this to me is a wonderful teaching. I love this because it's the hardest thing in the world, forgiveness. Yet I also know that if you carry, if you have resentment and you have anger, you're harboring a thief in your heart. So for your health, physically and emotionally, you got to get rid of. And furthermore, we have a model for this. It's great models in Torah. God is angry. We see God angry. We see Moses angry. And there's a point in Exodus where God sees that one day God's going to be angry at the Israelites and Moses is going to be angry at the Israelites, and that is going to be a really bad day. So God says to Moses, look, you've got to remind me of my own kindness. I mean, I love the notion, this dialogue. God needs Moses' help. Sing these words to me. And he sings these words, Adonai, Adonai, El Rachum V'chanun. And it goes on, 13 attributes of kindness, each one slightly different. The God who forgives before we sin. Easy.
God of compassion and grace, slow to anger, generous in love and truth, showing love to thousands, forgiving sin, wrong, and failure, who pardons?
On the money.
Well, that's your...
That's right. That's it.
Yeah.
Right out of Exodus. Well, I didn't write those glorious words, but what I take to my heart every day, because we began this with, you know, how does this work for me, Malka, is I see, this is very reassuring to me, even God needs reminding to be kind. So, you know, when I'm behaving in a certain way, I count on my partner to hold the bigger vision of Malka, to remind me that I'm more than this lower moment that I may be having, and that I have this responsibility with others also, to remember. I mean, imagine what this world would be if we always behaved in seeing each other as part of the divine, in the divine image. So if we hold that, I mean, here, God is asking Moses, I need you.
Yeah, and I like what you how you ended that. In this passage from Exodus, 13 qualities of God, and they all have to do with mercy. And it's interesting because one of the things I'd learned a couple of years ago, I had a Sufi master on, and we were talking about the Quran, and he told me that there were 99 descriptives of Allah in the Quran, and the highest descriptive was mercy. Ahead of compassion, ahead of love, is mercy. And when I saw that, it just resonated. And it just, again, also proves that common base that there is, all this information is there, you know, in any religion. It's, you know.
Well, let's go back to girl talk.
Go for it.
So in Hebrew, the word for compassion comes from the, it means, is rachamim. And the root of that is rechem, womb. So this is the God from whose womb we have all come. Compassion is the womb. And this God who keeps the world in balance with justice and mercy, we always say, in a pinch, lean on mercy. And again, how do we know what God is and how do we behave like God? We have these little hints along the way. Here's the God who clothes the naked, feeds the hungry. I mean, this is the work. It's right on the ground.
Yeah, and
so that's the tender that we're really reaching for, that we need so desperately to break our fear of each other.
Was this focus on the tenderness something that you found on your own, or was this something you were guided to?
Good question. I think that, first of all, the teacher for me on this one, I think, is gender. I mean, I think that being a woman and a mother, and now especially a grandmother, which is, now I know everything.
okay.
Yeah, my grandson Solomon has taught me everything. He's 18 months old. But I see that that this piece about loving, this piece about understanding, the first thing we know about this God is what? That this God that Christians, Jews, and Muslims understand, first thing is creation. First commandment is be fruitful and multiply. So we have already creation. Well, you know, I have a body that speaks of creation. I have a body that speaks of nurturance. So I think that I was led in looking for this God that I could identify with, and it wasn't going to be this beard. That I was going to be looking for that God that also represented the creative and the nurturing aspect because I was a woman. So I think in some ways, although many of my teachers, maybe most, have been men, that I've heard in them, because this is not a gender deal. I mean, these men that I know are wonderful male mothers. There's no question about it, because they, as you say, speak all the time of the mercy. And this I hear in my tradition.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I think that the closer we come to the Creator, however we define or name that Creator, I think the more we have to balance the yin and the yang, the attributes of the male and the female. You know, so the more I become a spiritual person, the more my spirituality grows, the more I start to blend the two. You know, and I think that's ultimately part of the lesson also, and that's part of why, for my own personal, I have a hard time with a gender-specific God. I'm part of a 12-step program, and there's readings in the 12-step program where they use the masculine, and I just refuse to use that because that's not my understanding, and the steps specifically ask you, you know, to God as you understood God, and they say it God as you understood him. Well, no. I don't understand God as a him. I understand God as neither or both, but I don't understand it as a singular. You know, and that's, I think, real important. We start to get that blending and we find out, you know, that we have all these qualities, and the more we connect, the more those qualities come forth in us. And that concept of mercy, I think, is really important, because it's, hey, I want to read you again here. I love reading you. Unconditional forgiveness. Only when one asks for it do we offer it. What we may not do is, when we are asked to forgive, to think he'll just do it again. Then it says here, judge yourself and forgive others. I mean, it's just, I think that's really what it's about. And to me, that also is the wisdom of the 12 steps, which I think is as ancient as all these religions, and they just kind of put it together in a simplistic way, because most people have those major behavior problems, need something simplistic to follow.
I think that's right, and I think that many people I know in 12-step found the spirit that way.
Well,
that was the path. They couldn't find it anyplace else.
That's where I found it.
So
you go. To go back here, I think I probably talked about this before, but one of the things I really objected to early on was, as I was a child, it was, the high holy days, and it was like, it was like not quite a major sin, but it was close to a major sin if you didn't attend service on those days. I mean, this is what you're supposed to do. If you never went any other day of the year, these days you were supposed to be there. The congregation I belonged to actually charged you for your seat to be there. I guess that was one of the forms of fundraising.
See, I think what we need to do is the opposite. See, I've told my people here in Santa Fe that we should have a sliding scale running this way. The more often you come,
the less you pay.
Yeah, you get a rebate if you come every Shabbos. And if you only come high holidays, it costs you $5,000 a year. That's what we should do.
Yeah. But I guess, what really hit me with the rabbi was that the fact that I was, I really didn't want to be there. And I was getting blackmailed into going, well, I bought you a ticket, you got to go. And I figured how much the tickets cost. Might have been $20, might have been $100. It's like way back. But the whole idea that I was supposed to be there, but in order to be there, I had to pay to be there, really rubbed me the wrong way. I mean, maybe it was because of the way it was used. I couldn't see the necessity of having a fundraising done that way, to the synagogue needed the money.
I felt that way too, Phil, until we actually started a congregation, and I realized that I wanted to be paid, and I couldn't figure out how that was going to happen. So on the other hand, I'll tell you a funny story about 12-step. I attended a certification for Jewish clergy of all denominations in 12-step. And it was an amazing experience, because you had a room full of addicts and a room full of rabbis, and sometimes they would be one and the same. And it was clear that those of us who had experienced what 12-step was about used language like miracle, grace,
yeah.
God is friend, God is close. And so many of the other clergy, just, it was us and them. They were on the other side of the pale. And then I realized that there are two kinds of effective spiritual leaders. There are the ones who really, the feet are a little bit off the ground. Dalai Lama. Just like, whoa. Then there are the other ones where you just say, my God, if she can do it, I can do it. And I really do feel that in many ways that my teaching may be that I have been there and I understand this and I am there and I am there every single day. And I do understand that this what we call having to work it is claiming to live, as I say, to behave with faith, to behave that there is a God. Because things like belief, it's like love, it comes and goes. But that's the piece that, while as a child, for you, that was a struggle, the notion of behavior, the deed, the ritual, if you will, the remembrance of a blessing, to remember that what you're eating is special. Those pieces, for me, even when I'm not conscious that I'm eating, I'm going to say those words. Because 10% of the time, I'm going to say, son of a gun, this is amazing, this carrot in front of me, because I've taken the time to say the blessing. So I do believe in the behavior.
And I agree, and I think the other 90%, even if we, you know, if it's a rote kind of thing, it's still stating a very powerful intent that we actually believe and want to connect. And whether it's with a whole consciousness or partial consciousness, I think it's still powerful. You know, the whole consciousness, I think, makes it a little bit more powerful. But even just to say it, I believe, is just like taking the time to reinforce a belief is such a powerful intent that, you know, it we become, not that we take it for granted, but we know it's always there.
Well, you know, Heschel says that prayer may not save us, but it makes us worth saving.
I like that.
So, and I think that for me, I had the same struggle you had. I mean, I wanted to be a Jew because, as I said, I loved my grandfather. But I also knew that that wasn't going to be enough. I mean, otherwise I would be like so many Jews or so many whomever, where their spirit comes from some other path, but their ethnic identity comes into this place. For me, it's very, very important to find a way for this to speak to my heart, not just my grandfather's. So you may remember that every prayer you say, blessed are you, Adonai, our God, God of our ancestors. So our God and God of our ancestors. The question is, Martin Buber says, why both? Isn't it enough for it to be our God? Or isn't it enough to be the God of our ancestors? And Buber says, no. If it's only our God, we're inventing a new religion. If it's only the God of our ancestors, what are we here for? So it really has to be the two together.
That constant connection, but also the evolution.
Right.
Yeah. And I guess that's part of my original comment. I never saw that evolution, every possibility, and I wasn't looking for it. Yeah, and the other thing that you said, which I'll need to qualify for myself, is I didn't want to be a Jew. I grew up in, well, I've talked about it before. I grew up in an abusive household. And I felt like, I mean, part of the message I had about me was I have enough problems in life. There's something wrong with me that I'm not going to be able to get through this life without problems. Being born in 49 and then just hearing from my family about what happened with the Holocaust and everything, I didn't want to be a Jew because I had enough problems. I didn't need to be persecuted for a religion I didn't even really believe in or buy into. I was just born into it and didn't understand it, didn't resonate with it. And I kind of disowned myself from it as quickly as I can. And that was part of it. I mean, there were a lot of factors that came together at the same time that, you know, created that feeling. But that was one of them. I just like, you know, I don't want to deal with this. I have enough problems to deal with. I don't need any more.
No, I think that what is terribly important for the spirit of any child, I mean, first of all, religion is completely irrelevant when they're suffering in a home. It has no place whatsoever. But you
exactly.
have a child. You have a child. One of the early concepts we have is that you take a child to learn the first day. The child's 5 years old. The child is carried in the father's prayer shawl, carried in his arms, in his prayer shawl, taken to the teacher. The teacher has a letter in front of the child. The letter is laced with honey. Takes the child's finger, draws the letter, taste it. Always associate learning with this sweetness and with this tenderness.
Where did this come from?
This is Eastern European. This is from the shtetl.
And if I experienced it, I don't remember it.
I'm sure not. But I think that regardless of what faith path you have, that Heschel said, what does it mean to believe in God? It means to have radical amazement. You remember years ago with Roots, when Kunta Kinte takes his child out to look at the stars and holds the baby up to look at the night sky? I mean, to me, when a child experiences that sense of wonder, that radical amazement, that really is more than anything, that's religion. That's religion. What you experienced in a home like that, how could you connect in any way to, I mean, there was no reason. There has to be a reason. You're a thinking human being from the day you're born. You have to have a reason, and you can't expect, especially today, I don't know, if I sit behind my desk waiting for people to come to me, nobody's going to come to me. No, my job is to be out there as sales rep for God, and I have to go out there and do like two that. Things. Walk the path for myself so that people can see that it's working for me.
Yeah, exactly.
And secondly, demonstrate that what it is teaching me to do is to reach to you in that place of love. And if that doesn't start right away, forget what religion it is. That child's spirit, that child mistrusts that place within him or herself to really believe that there is connection that cannot be seen. You talk about gender. Him comes into it because Hebrew is a gender-specific language. You know, it's like Spanish. Okay. The notion of the non-corporeal God is very important. The non-visible God is key. I teach little kids. I say, where's God? Okay. Where's your arm? Good. Where's your nose? Good. Where's your love? But do you feel my love for you? Yes. But where is it? But if a child grows up without that sense of tenderness and it's not pointed out, there are many things in this life that can't be touched. The child's not going to trust anything except, you know, a Ferrari,
a
girl, whatever.
The material stuff.
That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had a few years ago, I had a half-hour show on Saturday, same station, a little bit later in the day. I had Rabbi Lev on, and we were talking, and I came to this, cause almost, you know, we didn't have the same conversation, but the point you just made, because I work in the field, I'm a counselor, and I work with not only substance abuse but mental health. What I've come to believe is that PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is the most prominent problem that we have today in individuals. And it's one of its symptoms, and it's a symptom that, just like you mentioned, which is not in the diagnostic manual that you're supposed to use, is that it disconnects us from the Creator, that we do not have a spirit. Our spirit is, when we are abused in any form, and it, you know, it could be mental, emotional, as well as physical or sexual, we lose that belief that there's something out there that cares for me. When I was talking to Rabbi Lev, something he had said, and it just dawned on me that the possibility that we are a PTSD society, that with the advent of mass communication starting back in the 40s and bringing right into our home all the horrors almost instantaneously, you know, first with radio, then with, you know, in between with like newsreels at the movie theaters, and, you know, then with television, you know, that concept that no matter where we are, we're not safe. And then we keep reinforcing that. So when we watch the news today and we watch, you know, 9 out of 10 items about neighbors getting murdered, robbed, raped, you know, abused, and yada, 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 we can't feel safe. And so we as a society have taken on addictions, which is materialism, and the materialism is the substitute for the Creator, because we don't get solace from the Creator, and when we stop believing, we stop connecting, we get solace in the things you talked about earlier, the Ferrari or whatever the car was, you know, well, this makes me, I'm okay now. And we've created false gods, you know, with the material stuff we own.
I think you're exactly right, Phil, and you've really put it into this moment. I mean, I think that everything I understand about this book is exactly that, is we're hardwired to go for what we touch. And yet, the truth is, I mean, all you're talking about is idolatry, a thousand ways to idolatry. But the notion in our time that we've terrified ourselves and that we have to anesthetize ourselves is a very interesting idea. I think that it's well said. One of the ideas of sin, in Hebrew, the word for sin is actually, it's an archer's term. It doesn't, sin is Latin, it's like a stain. But in Hebrew, the word hate means missing the mark, like an archer. That's what it means to what we might call sin. But that's a different, if you miss the mark, it means that God is here. And it's distance from God is what sin is.
I'm going to quote you again. Over and over we stumble and fall, and always God waits patiently. We are hardwired for flaw, for sin, if you will. It's how we learn. That we sin is our salvation, because only through repentance can we gain a new heart and become better people. And then you go on to say, if you are magnanimous and forgive, all your sins are forgiven. And then God never gives up on us, always waiting for us to return.
I want to go back to this about materialism, because I think your point is excellent about this. And I wrote a sermon some time ago about when I was really got into the 12-step program, and I'll tell you how I got in. I went into Al-Anon, and I went into Al-Anon because I recognized that probably 99.9% of all clergy was codependent with its community, and that because you got to be broken so I can be the one who knows everything.
Yeah.
And I saw that there was so much of this idea that we live in a society that also says, talk about materialism, if you aren't all-powerful, I mean, little engine than could, all of us cut our teeth on this, you just work hard enough, you're going to get it. And it's a lie, because first of all, when you get to be of a certain age, you realize you begin to lose some of your physical power. What happens if you lose your money? What happens if you lose your physical power? Then suddenly, little engine that could paradigm doesn't work anymore. You know very well, I'm sure, being a counselor, how much alcoholism there is in the senior community. Forget the young. I think it's the despair of feeling that you're no longer worth anything in a society where you can't produce and produce and produce.
Yeah. And about the alcoholism, the abuse of prescription drugs.
Exactly.
I want to move on, because kind of what we're touching on, again, comes another one of your sermons. Tell me if I'm pronouncing this right. Echo Kashrut?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me quote you again. All urban civilizations have lost the ability to be radically amazed by the miracle of air, land, soil, water, and species. Instead, we human view the world as ours to do with as we wish for our own gain and comfort without thinking about how we deplete the world. We live without fear of the consequences because we live without fear of God. And that's exactly it. You know, to me, that's the whole materialism. There are no consequences. I'm here for me right here, right now. You know, and it's I see no responsibility for those who are here with me, nor do I have any responsibility for those who come after me.
That's
which
right.
is so contrary, because yet we fight for those to pass on the power. You know, we set up all these laws about inheritance and pass on the wealth. But we're passing on a polluted, destroyed planet. I mean, to me, and it's the same people who are passing on all this wealth who are tearing apart this planet. And it's such a contradiction. You know, why are you bothering to save something for this person, but you're not saving what they're living on?
I think that that's right. This year for High Holidays, I've decided to I like to always sort of have a theme for my teaching. So I want to do near opposites this year. And, for example, I'm doing prayer and blessing. but I'm also doing fear and awe. And the difference between these two. Fear is like lower than awe. I mean, in other words, people start out not doing things maybe because they're afraid something horrible will happen to them. You know, if there weren't a stop sign. Yeah. If there weren't a stop sign, you wouldn't stop. But fundamentally, if you can get people into a place of awe during the days of awe to realize what is at stake. See, we do live. See, I think we do live in a scary world. I mean, in other words, I'm very careful about how much I let myself. I mean, just like what I eat, I'm somewhat careful about what I allow coming in. I read the New York Times every morning, in a limited dosage. If I find myself becoming obsessed with something, I stop because it puts me in a negative space. But I do think that this is a scary time. I just came back from California, found little things in my suitcases that said, "Your bags have been inspected." This is part of...
That's because you look so much like a terrorist.
And you don't know that. I know you don't know until you get home and you start to go put away your underwear that somebody's been through it, right? And this is all in the name of security, I think. Is that right? And I realize that this is a very scary time for civil liberties, scary time for environment, scary time in many places. So what do we do with this and not become addicts? What I really have decided is that I'm going to let every one of these things be big time wake up call for gratitude for what I do have, and big time gratitude to remind me that I have to work, and every one of us, there is no time to waste to do what we can to save this world that we have and to claim back. I mean, I was with my father, and he said, "Well, I'm sure that when this is over, they'll stop doing this. You know, they'll no longer be inspecting our luggage." And I said, "Not if we fight. If we don't fight like hell, because we're fighting hell, we're not going to get this freedom back again, this freedom of privacy."
I want to read one more thing of yours, then we're going to have to put a wrap on this. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. From the fourth sermon, Numbering My Days, "I know that I should make every day count by being conscious that every moment offers an opportunity to draw closer to the holy." And I think that's what we're missing, what you're just saying. We're looking at the opposite. Every moment draws us closer to the unholy, and I think that's... we're being led by fear and negativism instead of by the Spirit and, you know, by that which is grace. Would you like to tell everybody how they can get a hold of you? had to break it off there, unfortunately. Maybe we'll come back and do another one. We got about 2 minutes left.
Sure.
So let them website. Give them the website. They can look up all this great stuff, and email, phone number, however you want to.
Sure. Well, there are two ways. First of all, my website is malkadrucker.com, MalkaDrucker.com. Secondly, we have a community here called HaMakom, the place for passionate and progressive Judaism. Our phone number is 992-1905. We meet every Saturday morning at Ponce de Leon at 9:30. We have Torah, bagels, and ecstatic prayer and singing, and we'd love to see anyone come who feels that they'd like any one of those three. And finally,
whose bagels?
Let's see.
Wolf?
No, I think that they're actually Bagel Mania.
They're
up here. We buy local.
That's acceptable,
and they're very fresh. That's too. We'd love to see you one Saturday morning. And the other thing I'd like to say is that. This idea of white fire is one that I feel is one to pay close attention to, and that if you come to my website, you'll be reading more about that, and we'll be having the White Fire Council set up very soon.
Very good. Malka, thank you so much for being here. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
I want to thank all of you out there listening. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. I'm not sure with who yet because I got time, but tune in. And may you always walk with God in love and light. Thank you.
And the people bowed and prayed to the neon God they made. And the sign flashed out its warning.
in the words that it was forming. And the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, in tenement halls, whispering the sounds of silence.